Well, hello, friends. Today is the 13th day of February, 2014, and I'm undertaking another one of my little experiments here. You know that I like to work in astrology, and it's not so very often that Uranus conjuncts your sun. So I have the sun in Aries at 10 plus degrees, and the third pass of Uranus over my sun occurs in just a few days, 4 days. And it has led me into some, I hope, interesting thoughts about simultaneity and sequence. Uranus is the planet of simultaneity, and Saturn the planet of sequence. In my own chart, 70 years ago, Uranus and Saturn were conjuncted. And so these two planets are of special interest to me and are at the top of a kind of five-pointed star in that chart. I think I've always understood sequence fairly well, and have been sometimes the victim of it, the victim of time. I'm not sure I have understood simultaneity, and I'm not sure that even in those days when I was writing The Infinitization of Selfhood, back from 1994 to 1996, that I really understood simultaneity. I'm not sure I understand it now. But my thoughts are prompted in that direction. And I know that in that earlier book, I did speak of the ongoingness of the boundless, immutable principle, which I attempted to call by so many names in that particular book. Of course, every such attempt really being futile, but evoking perhaps something in the mind which brings us closer to an appreciation of what it is, or at the very least, of what it is not. So I'm calling this basically yesterday. I was consulting my thoughts and my so-called little red book in which I jot down thoughts concerning reality, what I consider to be reality. The consideration is likely to change over the years, of course, and in future cycles. But I jotted down a few thoughts and tried to systematize them a little bit. There's some 12 pages here, which I would like to go over with you. I do not think that simply sending it to you will be sufficient. I'd like to kind of round off what I'm saying here and indicate those thoughts of which I feel relatively certain and those which are more hypothetical. All of this meant to be of assistance to you as you undertake your own quest into the discovery of what reality may be, especially what it may be for you. I call this simultaneity and sequence, or now as ever, now as forever. There seems to be such a contrast in our thoughts between the moment we call now and the infinite eternal span that we think of as ever or forever. And yet there may be a paradoxical kind of equivalence between the now and foreverness. I know it seems, I think I'll put these in caps. The difference seems absolute between a beginningless, endless span of events such as the appearance and disappearance of universes. And this transitory, well, what can we call it? Moment in time, point in time. Later I will elaborate on why I think it's neither of those, which we call the now. Is it possible that foreverness or everness can be contained in an eternal now, which is a form, a term, the eternal now, given to us by the mystics of the ages, and indicates something that they have perceived in what we would call altered states of consciousness? So is this really a possibility, that there is an ongoing now, and I would call it an immovable now, which somehow contains, embodies, includes all we think of as foreverness and everness? The thought seems to contradict reason. And yet I will attempt to show that it may be worth thinking in this direction. So the purpose of this discussion, what I'll do is kind of, you know, read some things that I've written down, and then maybe elaborate a little bit. The purpose of this discussion is to offer some thoughts about the nature of reality. Not reality as most of us usually conceive of it, but a reality in full caps here, which transcends that self-objectification we call the universe. Well, maybe the best thing would be to bring this image up out of the way. Reality. We usually say, well, what the senses reveal is reality. What our thoughts ponder may be reality. It's everything that we sense and register here and now, and register and will register in the future using this type of instrumentation that we have. But of course, I'm saying that while these normal registrations to and in our brain consciousness may be aspects of reality, they are certainly not the whole thing, and in a way, they misrepresent what reality more deeply is. Reality is paradoxical in a sense. It's like infinitely remote to such an extent that it may be unregisterable or unperceivable whilst in universe. But on the other hand, there's nothing else but it, so even any illusion is an aspect of the reality. Even the process of perceiving in an illusory manner exists because the fundamental reality is all there is and underlies and actually is all of those illusions as well. The universe, the reality I've sometimes called the absolute self. Some of the Buddhists will protest against the word self, but by that word I do not mean any limited condition. I mean a totally unlimited condition, an infinitely infinite condition. Nor is it correct to call it a condition at all, because this implies mutability, changeability, variability, partition, division, multiplicity, and all of that is essentially excluded from what I call reality. And yet, as this self, this utter reality, descends to manifest, that's what the Tibetan calls it, at a certain point when he's speaking of the seeds of all philosophy, being descends to manifest. When it descends to manifest, it is really a self-becoming. Everything that one registers in any way is an aspect of the one immutable self that one is. Of course, to call it immutable and yet to say that it generates mutability is a philosophical problem, but so it seems to be. So the purpose of this discussion is to offer some thoughts, maybe even some ideas, as we know that ideas are primary to thoughts, and thoughts are an attempt to clothe these living beings, called ideas, in some rational form, which is apprehensible by the student. So maybe some ideas will also come in, and maybe I will also write in red occasionally here as other thoughts occur. So this is not reality as most of us usually conceive of it, which is simply our everyday experience. We call that real. I call it actual. Not real. I call it actual. I call it an illusion in consciousness. But more of that as we go along. Now, some of you who are readers of Infinitization of Selfhood, and there are very few, one day I'm even threatening myself to reread it. But you will recognize some of these thoughts or ideas. But I'm carrying things a bit farther, I think. So everything that is content in our consciousness, and all things are contents in the consciousness of, let us say, the universal logos, all those contents of consciousness are really self-objectifications. They are the opportunity for us to experience limitation. That's what I think self-objectification is. Aha. The opportunity, let's see if I can do this, the opportunity for us to experience limitation. If we, the terminology, if we, the I, experience ourselves, it is utter limitlessness. And maybe we get tired of that. Of course, I'm speaking in colloquial terms. There's a kind of a channeling that HBB wrote about through her friend Dr. Anna Kingsford, and the source in that particular transmission dealt with the idea that, well, why is there a universe? Why is there multiplicity? And the idea was so that, this is a trivial expression, but so that God, the absolute deity, could have some company within himself. And even the idea of evil was related to that. Evil and limitation are allied. And the absolute deity, cyclically, apparently, needs the state of limitation, multiplicity, variety, perhaps for relief from its utterness, its all-in-allness, its absoluteness. I dealt with some of these ideas in the Infinitization book, but the important thing to remember is that whatever you see is you. And that whether good or evil, if it's registered, and even if it's not registered, it is the objectification, the sending forth into perceivability of the one and only self. I think I'll write that down. The send, or, well, let's call it this, raying forth into perceivability of the one and only self. One and only self. Now, what I might do at some point is actually read this thing through without the interruptions of my thoughts. But for right now, I'm just moving through this a little at a time and trying to elaborate somewhat. We're on the quest for reality, and the theme of simultaneity and sequence has a lot to do with that particular pursuit. And also, we hope that we will come to the point where we can understand that eternal nowness and foreverness are identical. That's what now as forever means, and now as ever. They are deeply contrasted in customary thought. Now is now, and forever is forever. But I'm attempting to collapse them into one identicality, into sameness. So the entire universe, is what I'm saying here, is a self-objectification into perceivability. The universe, I suspect, in that state, it's not a proper word, in that state of all in allness, of utterness, of infinitescence, is not perceived. Or perhaps an infinitude of universes is simultaneously perceived. That's another thought that I had not really entertained so much in my infinitization book, but reasoning leads to that possibility. And I will bring it forward. To read all of this, these 12 pages or so, straight through, without interruption, will reveal that it is somewhat systematic in its presentation. Obviously, I'm sacrificing the systematization for a little bit of a conversation with you and with myself on these subjects. So just remember that whatever you see, whatever you feel, whatever you touch, whatever you register in any way, is no different from what you are. It is a limited condition of the one self, and maybe, since fundamentally the one self cannot, by definition, be limited, the absolute cannot be limited, maybe what we perceive as a limited condition is also the, in some strange way, the fullness of the one self, of the absolute, of the infinitescence, of the, well, I think I had some ungainly number, like 241 names for the nameless in my book. But I will just refer to that. That's how the Hindus understand it, the Brahmins, the great philosophers of India, as that. Maybe I'll refer to that by a number of names, not in the hope that it really can reveal what that is, because I don't think that within this true point that we call the universe, we can ever understand with infinite intensity what that is, or experience with infinite intensity what that is, as we can when there is no point, I hypothesize. But perhaps we can, through these different names, come closer to what that is not, and have a kind of intuition or feeling for what that might be, even though in a way we're infinitely removed from, at the moment in our present state of consciousness, from what that actually is. So in approaching this extremely difficult and in many respects impossible subject, nothing like attempting the impossible. It's this classic Aries approach, you know, and Saturn tells you what's possible and not, and it falls in the sign Aries, so you just attempt what can't be done, but okay, you go down trying. In this extremely difficult and in many respects impossible subject in the approach to it, I'm going to speak just in normal language, conventional language, as a human being, which I appear to be and which you appear to be and which really we're not, or we are in one way if not in another. I say essentially I'm not a human being, essentially, that word essentially is so important, and none of us are really human beings, though we are in the special condition of humanhood at this time, but perhaps as well, we are simultaneously in all other states as well as the human state. Being the one life, we're not just limited to being human, we are, I would say, simultaneously all things from the atom to the greatest God and more. So I say this will seem a strange statement to many, but it's not so strange to those who whose objective it is to identify, I wouldn't say with being, I'd say as being. I think what we're looking for here is the experience of being being. It may seem we're just playing with words like how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, but no, I think we're talking about real things here. The experience of being being and falling short of that, of being being, the being of the universal logos. Well, first things first, I think. Although in a way there is no distinction of one thing from another, except in the world of illusion, and the universe, or any universe, is the world of illusion. Not illusion as it's usually referred to when we talk about a deluded or a deluded individual who is just not thinking straight, but the fundamental illusion that the universe is. All is illusion, O dweller in the shadows. We hear in the third stanza for the Blessed Ones the discussion of the third ray monad and its approach. All is illusion, O dweller in the shadows. Well, maybe I should take the Tibetan seriously in his use of the word all. All. Everything that is, including a universe, is illusion. As I said in infinitization, you know, there's these words, live, evil, veil, vile. They all are permutations of each other. And inevitably, we live in this universe, and we'll discover that we live as this universe, and we will discover that it is a veil upon what we actually are, but it's a necessary illusion, a necessary veil, and maybe, given the indivisibility of the Absolute, it is exactly what we are. I cannot help but speak in terms paradoxical, because I think that rigorous following of logic will lead us to contradiction, so I've even called the great being the great contradiction. Maybe I should call it the great non-being. Anyway, thou art that, we are that, the we seem to be are that exactly, and it's just coming to terms with that, really. Somehow detecting thatness or suchness in the midst of all of our multiple experiences, or our experience with multiplicity, our registration of multiplicity. So, yes, attempting the impossible, because all one can do is really come a little closer to that from which we have no distance, to speak again in paradox. But we know what it is in ordinary consciousness to feel separated from a registration and apprehension. We know when we get it and when we don't. So maybe we can come a little closer to, as it were, getting it, you know. I always start out experimentally here, you know, if I were not into taking chances, and in one way I'm not into taking chances, I would write a rigorous book about this. But in a way I've done that, although it could be more rigorous, could have been more rigorous. I've done that, and I thought maybe the conversational approach would serve the purpose of bringing us closer to that from which we have never been separated. I will speak in terms of contradiction, assuming that the contradictions will be shown through correct experience to be actually real. I don't mean real contradictions, I mean that the experience, though apparently contradictory, is a real experience. So how I'll go about this as I write or talk, I'll use the convention of single quotation marks to indicate a non-literal use of a particular word, or particular words or phrases. No words really serve. And when a word has an ordinary meaning, and yet you're using it in a way that is to mean something quite different, much deeper, I often put these in single quotes to say, don't take this literally. This is really a symbol of something that I cannot touch with other words. So the words or phrases do not exactly define, far from it, that to which they refer, but they perhaps suggest that not yet apprehended state, as well as it can be suggested, at least as well as I can suggest it. All these words would not be needed by many people. I mean, there are some that just don't need all this, you know. They just know. The Buddha, you know, we would say, he was suchness. He knew suchness, he understood suchness, and more than that, he was suchness. And so all of these words are an attempt by someone who is not yet fully consciously suchness to reach a closer apprehension or sense of being suchness. And you will recognize to a degree the use of the third ray here, and hopefully you can tolerate it. I will also use bold case when the words and phrases which pertain to the ultimate state of being, or beingness, as HBB has called it, or beingness. So words or phrases pertain to the ultimate state of being, or beingness, and not to beings in a relative state, great beings, lesser beings. No matter how great that state may appear to be from the limited human perspective. In other words, the greatest being in cosmos, any cosmos, is the being who in a sense is cosmos, and that is the universal logos, but I don't refer to the universal logos in full bold letters. Let's see. Universal logos. They have the first letters capitalized, but not universal logos all in bold, because then I'm talking about what I shouldn't be talking about. In other words, I'm talking about the completely unknown, the nameless one, or the nameless none, as some people like to call it zero. I'm not sure if zero is useful, yes, in terms of indicating that it is completely homogeneous and no articulated or enumerated thing is found within it. But inasmuch as it is infinite abundance, a super infinite abundance, inasmuch as it is the infinity of infinities, absolute infinity, it's hard to call it zero, you know, because zero seems to be at the other extreme from absolute infinity. Although in a way it's quite close, Because absolute infinity, well, it shows that it somehow contains infinite variety in one way, and yet is no thing at all itself. So zero can indicate no thingness. Let's say zero indicates no thingness. And perhaps it'd be better to do it this way, no thingness, because we're talking about, in fully bold letters, the one and only no thing. And from it, as self-objectifications come the things. From it, as self-objectifications come what? Well, how shall I put it? Come things. Great things and small things. Anything arises from it as a self-objectification. So that was the convention that I used in infinitization of selfhood. The use of bold case when referring to absolute reality, absolute infinitude, the infinitely infinite, you know, you could just turn blue trying to find names to suggest how different it is from all the things we're used to. Now, I will say that some of the thoughts here in this little, well, listing of points, just 12 computer pages of them, some of the thoughts here maybe I should be a little bit more conservative, may transcend thoughts offered in infinitization of selfhood. I would nevertheless recommend the study of that book for definitions and refinements of thought, which are too elaborate to be mentioned here. Actually, I paid a lot of attention to the universe. A lot of attention to the universe in infinitization of selfhood. In other words, the great self-objectification, you know, what is it? What is its relation to that which is not self-objectified? I work to redefine the universe and the series of universes and put them in a certain context. So I paid a lot of attention to, in a way, what is going on, what is happening, apparently happening, in universe. In this particular approach, I'm paying less attention to that, and more attention to absoluteness. Maybe I have no right to do that, you know, because that in a way is absolutely forbidden. You can't really say anything about it that is true, you know, but maybe you can say something about it which is truer than customary thought inclines towards. So maybe some of these thoughts will take things a little further. I think the seeds were found in infinitization of selfhood. Maybe I did not elaborate them or follow out the implications. You see, I put a lot of stress there in the idea that there is an endless sequence of universes and the great breath forever breathes. But here I am looking at the great breath as a secondary factor to the boundless immutable principle. I think I did there as well, but I really gave credence to the idea of an endless duration in which countless universes appear and disappear, having done so forever and doing so forever. There's so many paradoxes when you start to use conventional language and you try to talk about infinitude, because language always wants to limit something, and infinitude is the unlimited. But now, now, I'm concentrating on the now, as if it is the only temporal descriptor, or the only descriptor of duration, which is real, all others being somehow a compromise or secondary. I'll get into that. So by paying more attention to the collapsing of infinite time into now, I am in a way transcending the emphasis that was in infinitization of self. As I said, I think the seeds were there. And I threw in so many thoughts there that somewhere one is going to find the seed to what is here being described. But now I'm emphasizing this, the utter collapsing of time and space to a point, and the collapsing of endless sequence into a point. This will be my emphasis. Now, you know, is it experienceable? I think to a degree experienceable. Or at least the trend towards such an experience can be established. In addition to our everyday experience, which we must sustain in order to practically live the life of the necessary illusion. But every once in a while, what's going on simultaneously forever in the eternal now may become the object of our attention. And I think it will be, in a sense, the maximal contrast possible. So I'm proposing that there will be some different thoughts offered in this little sequence of thoughts. Thoughts which have a different emphasis from infinitization and may at times seem to contradict what is emphasized there. I'm remembering, you know, two men who are Gemini, Walt Whitman and Ralph Waldo Emerson. They didn't like consistency too much. Walt Whitman being first ray, he said, "Well, do I contradict myself? Very well then, I contradict myself." Okay, the first ray approach. And Emerson saying something like, "A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds." It's something like that, quite close. You get the idea that he's not going to be one to be given to perpetuating a foolish consistency. Of course, with that qualifier, maybe there is a wise consistency too, but this leaves the door open to the wisdom of paradox. And I think with the discoveries in particle physics, we cannot help but entertain the value of attempting to come to terms with paradox. Do I dare say understand it? I don't know if I dare say understand paradox. Well, when I wrote infinitization, I found that many problems in philosophy, I call them that, maybe other people wouldn't consider them problems at all, you know, they arose, and I could not solve them. And these problems perhaps are such that I would not be able to solve them in incarnations to come. And then I venture further by saying, well, perhaps they are insoluble by human beings. Perhaps only those beings who express through higher kingdoms can actually solve them. And then, kind of a venturesome thought, perhaps they are insoluble in universe. When I say in universe, I mean in the condition of this limited consciousness, which the appearance of universe forces upon the absolute consciousness, or which the absolute being, non-being, forces upon itself. Maybe no being in cosmos can solve some of these problems, because maybe the solution lies in being the one and only, with full intensity of registration. So I'll say, perhaps the solution lies in being the one and only, O-A-O, in in infinite fullness, with infinite intensity of registration, or I would say better, of self registration. In other words, what I'm saying is that here within the point, and I'll deal with points because that's a big part of what I'm going to try to talk about, the universe is a point, I assert, or I hypothesize. Asserting is of the first ray, hypothesis of the fifth. The universe is a point, and when, quote, contained within that point, any being, big or small, cannot possibly have infinite intensity of registration, infinite intensity of self-registration. Actually, I want to infinite intensity of self-registration. I think this is reserved, well, you know, that considers time, of course. It's reserved for those points in endless duration when the point is not. It's reserved for the state of pointlessness. But then I raise this really troubling question. Is there ever a state of pointlessness without pointness? Now, when we view the secret doctrine and read the earliest parts of it, we realize there's a great breadth, and so there is the alternation between pointless, pointness, pointless, pointness. And when I say, someone will joke and say, yeah, the whole thing is pointless, but I mean that there is no other existence than it. Every other existence I deem to be a point, and of course there is no other existence, so the appearance of points is problematic, and yet it seems to be what occurs in illusion. Then why illusion? Well, it's the great Mahamaya, and it seems to be necessary, and I've given, oh, probably a few crazy reasons why the appearance of the Mahamaya, the universe, is necessary. Mahamaya is the point, and there's only one. But I'll get into that. I keep promising that I'll get into it, and then at one point, maybe in this discussion, I'll say, well, I got into that before, and you'll discover that I never got into it at all. But I do intend, actually, to get into it. Get into it. Well, we're all not only into it, we are it. The point is bringing that realization into our everyday, very limited, waking consciousness. So I've wondered whether some of these problems, I certainly know they're not, I can't solve them. I can only suggest possible methods of solution. I also suggest that maybe only high beings can solve them. And I sometimes wonder, I guess that's what it is, whether even the great beings can solve them, because it seems to me that only in the infinite intensity of self-registration, which I call being the one and only being, can these things be, fully understood. I'm forced to fall back on conventional words, which dissatisfy me, but okay. That's what I have. And then I said also, in deference to those who think that what I'm talking is complete nonsense, that maybe these problems do not really exist at all, but only seem to exist from the perspective of human consciousness, and maybe once we abstract or retract into less limited conditions along our emanative stream and become members of higher kingdoms, then maybe the problems don't exist at all. Maybe it's just the difficulties within the human brain, the limitations of the human brain and the human mind, which make it seem as if there is problems. But here we are human beings, and there appear to be problems. So it is necessary then to address them, because they are like knots which prevent our full release into what we intuit as greater realization. So we will attempt some solutions, or at least indicate what they might be. So I sometimes, pondering these problems, found myself entertaining speculations which I call counterintuitive, meaning it would seem, the intuition seems to indicate, that the solution is one thing, but reasoning, as rigorously as I could, seems to indicate a different solution, which what I call the intuition does not indicate. I realize I'm trapped in my brain condition consciousness to a degree, as we all are to a degree. And what we sometimes deem as an intuitive indication, maybe that which accords with what our normal consciousness reveals. And we say, ah, yeah, this is true. But we compare it with what we think is true in our normal brain conditioned consciousness. And maybe the real truth is so utterly strange, so different from what our normal brain conditioned consciousness reveals, that we simply cannot cross the span. We cannot recognize the counterintuitive as truthful, as real. I mean, give you one example. I say it's all occurring now. And yet we know that we have the experience of time. And this experience of time tells us, our normal brain conditioned consciousness, that it's not all appearing now. There's a now-now, there's a now-then, there's a now-to-come. And things, events occurred then and will occur in the future and are occurring now. It's not all occurring now in any absolute sense. So at first, the eternal now seems counterintuitive, but maybe to the higher consciousness it's not counterintuitive. It's very intuitive. Another idea is that look at all the things that are happening. And along comes the idea that nothing is really happening. Nothing can happen because of the immutability of the boundless immutable principle. So nothing is really happening. It only seems to happen. So if I hold to the idea that nothing is really happening, I'm faced with the testimony of my brain-conditioned consciousness, which tells me that ever so many things are happening and being registered. Can I get into that? Can I find myself in that state of consciousness? or apprehension or being, when I know it is true, that nothing is really happening, that all that seems to be happening is the same thing being. Maybe I better write that down or I'll forget it. Maybe it deserves to be forgotten. All that is really, all that is really happening is the same, is, I'll put it more accurately, sameness, being, using being as a verb. Being, or sameness, being what it is. Maybe that's easier to understand. So, human being is registering happenings, when what is really happening is sameness being what it is, or sameness being. Inviolable sameness, being exactly what it is and always has been, and we confuse that as happenings. What is the transposition between continuous sameness and apparent variety? Well, I decided, I say, to do the brave thing. Is it brave or is it foolhardy? And proceed with these speculations and the implications which could be derived from them, at least some of the implications. I know there are implications here that I cannot track. And someone will say, well, the implication is it's all nonsense. Well, nonsense in a way, I agree, nonsense. So I decided to pursue the implications to the power that I, with the degree of power that I have. Even if they seem to run counter to philosophical conclusions I had previously laboriously reached, because I knew I was operating in a state of limitation when I wrote that book, and I'm operating in a state of limitation now. But maybe lesser limitation. Or who knows, maybe the veil has fallen and is thicker yet, and I'm operating in a state of greater limitation than in a condition of revelation which I achieved at that time. But I will assume that I'm operating in a state of lesser limitation, and so even though I might find myself contradicting myself in my earlier writing, I will proceed. Is it possible for me to annihilate infinite sequence and yet not annihilate infinite sequence? Can I annihilate infinite sequence in the absolute now and yet not annihilate the experience of infinite sequence? Or shall I simultaneize? what word would that be? Render simultaneous. Simultanate. You know, I love neologisms, you know, I love when one word can capture everything. But of course you blunder into stupid words when you try that, but okay. Simultaneate, how's that? Wow. Can I simultaneate infinite sequence so that everything that appears to ever have been or ever will be found occurring now and only now, ever now? Well, you see where one might run into what appears to be counterintuitive. That could be problematic. So I do not pretend that what will be discussed below will offer a real solution, resolution. Well, I put in maybe I should just make that all bold, because I have a feeling that the real resolution only exists as the real. The real is the resolution. Yeah, but why not? Why not put that down? You know, the real is the resolution. Well, I do not pretend, though I wish I could, that what will be discussed below offers the real resolution to these problems I've run into, maybe problems of the limited human mind, to some very difficult resolution to some very difficult philosophical problems, and also to my deficiencies, and in general to human deficiencies, in the registration of reality. I do not pretend it. But, you know, you feel compelled sometimes to pursue. Take the risk. You don't know you will succeed. You know that there will be success. It just might not occur in this cycle of illusory time. And yet, from a certain point of view, the resolution has already forever occurred. Because the be-ness is the resolution. But still, you know, in this world consciousness in illusion, we have to function according to the parameters of that limited state, and we have to do those things which pertain to that state, and we cannot pretend to have the full intensity of infinite consciousness at all times, which we really have. We cannot pretend to have what we really have. Okay, more paradox. We have it. We are it. But we also have to function in the Mahamayavic state. So I simply offer a sincere, well, I think it's sincere. I'm earnest in this. I simply offer a sincere probe into the science of being. Maybe the art of being is another thing, because it has to do with how you can apply the realizations of being to the presented world, to that which is presented to consciousness, to your contents of consciousness. So, but it is there's also a knowledge, a systematic approach, I think, to unveiling being successively, even though it is forever totally unveiled. And even though I, as being, know it is totally unveiled, were I not dimensionally sealed away in the point. I developed this idea of dimensional sealing in the book Infinitization. So then, this probe will proceed on the basis of philosophical speculation, mathematical, metaphysical speculation. Well, I'm not a mathematician. I have all the instincts to be, but probably not the ability. But when it comes to, I realize, with Georg Cantor, though I do not have his ability, that proving God or describing the nature of God requires a certain type of mathematics that maybe has not yet been evolved by human beings, but which exists. And so I have this kind of intuition that it exists and that it hovers around the relationship between infinitude, one, and zero. And, you know, although my attempts to enter this realm are halting, and I would say untrained, because I have not, you know, I don't have a PhD in higher mathematics. I have not made a lifelong study of it. Still, I find my thoughts are drawn to certain mathematical concepts, which are quite close to metaphysical concepts, and which I think are necessary in order to share some tentative conclusions at which I am arriving. So I call it metaphysical, mathematical, metaphysical, metaphysical, mathematical speculation. And maybe one day I will also have the training in the real higher math to be able to go further with it. Right now it is a means to the end of producing greater identification as reality among human beings. So it will proceed on the basis of reason, such reasoning as I can perform, study. I studied a lot, and some of that will come into it, but much further study, especially in mathematics, is needed. Faith, absolutely, as the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things unseen. I always get that reversed. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things unseen. Faith in the writings and pronouncements of the great teachers, such as the Master Jwalkul, such as the great sage Shankara, such as the Buddha, such as the Christ. Faith that what they say is real, or represents the real. And as much of the intuition as may dawn on my all-too-human brain-conditioned consciousness. Well, I'm not a human being, neither are you. I mean, we are and we aren't, you know. We are human, we're not human. Essentially, we are being in a specialized case called humanhood. Okay. So that's how I will proceed. Using all these things in some sort of mixture, there may be perhaps many necessary steps in the reasoning below which may be missing. So I don't, what follows is by no means a completed presentation. I mean, when I wrote Infinitization, which is, I don't know, maybe almost 1,000 pages, it was nowhere near complete. And certainly in this little sequential presentation of thoughts, there's no completeness. It could take years for me to complete, given the present limitations of my mind and consciousness, and even then, the so-called completion would be but partial. I think there's only one completeness that is, and it's the completeness of the infinity of all infinities, of the absolute infinitude. That's the only completeness. So, but even in relative terms, it would be partial. Still, an attempt must be made to present to those who may be interested certain, at least for me, excessively insistent ideas. You know, they're really, really rapping here at the mind and the brain. To present to those who may be interested certain excessively insistent ideas which have come to me. Actually, they won't let go of me, is what it's all about, and which may hopefully reorder, clarify, and somewhat liberate the thinking process of some interested readers, viewers, listeners, because you can do all three. You can read this, you can view it as the video, you can listen to it as a tape, not tape anymore, but audio program. Liberate the thinking process of some interested readers, viewers, listeners in such a way that what we call reality may be more readily apprehended. And this I have discussed. Some of us have a passion for reality. It's like having a passion for what you already are. But we want to bring together being and consciousness. Consciousness is limited. At least our consciousness, and being can never be limited. Being is the absolutely unlimited. It's the very core of the monad. It's the very core of the monad of the universal logos. It's the very essence of selfhood. It is absolutely unlimited. The infinity of all infinities. In the some of the definitions of Spinoza at the beginning of his Ethics, because he really wanted to take it right down into human behavior. God is a being infinite in an infinite number of ways, something to that effect. God is infinitely infinite. By God, I don't mean some other being other than myself. That's where all the mistakes are made. The assignment of otherness to God. You know, religion as presently conceived and practiced is always dealing with the otherness of God, in so many cases anyway. And those are very limited presentations, and they are based upon the limitations of the concrete mind, which tends to create distinction. There is only illusory distinction. It's practical, it's useful in the illusory world, but there is no real distinction, and it takes a long time for a mind used in a certain way to come to the point where it realizes that distinctions are illusory, such as the distinction between God and anything else. People will call it pantheism, but I do think that a philosophical pantheism is a wise approach. There is nothing that is not God. But as far as the fullness of God, the absolute deity goes, the things which appear to be do in a way misrepresent the fullness of God. They are veils upon the full intensity of God's own self-realization. I do realize the hopelessness of words, but since they are all I have at the moment, I have to use them in the hope that as energy symbols they may trigger realization in unexpected ways. Even I hope for realization within my own limited consciousness as I talk about these things, because a trigger may go off and say, aha, yet more, yet more. So there will be no complete presentation, as must be obvious by now. And hopefully for some of you it will be useful. We want to be practically useful in the world. We want to improve, I call it improve the illusion, archetypalize the illusion, perfect the illusion. It's all illusion. All is illusion, O dweller in the shadows. You cannot perfect being. You cannot perfect absolute infinitude. You cannot perfect the infinite essence. It is utterly perfect. Not just relatively perfect, as when a partial whole is completed, but utterly perfect. So, we have to be practical in this ever-recurring or simultaneously existing, I haven't decided which or both, illusion. According to the great breath, it ever recurs cyclically. According to some new thoughts I have on simultaneity, it may be ever-present, but not experientially ever-present. And that's a big problem. Certainly we will experience a, quote, time when we are not within the one and only point, and we are not within illusion, and we are God all in all. But the point is, the all in allness of God is forever. And there's no time. Well, that's true. There's no time when we're ever not fully that. It's not like God alternates between being partially God and then fully God. Fully God, partially God. No, no. It's not like God turns himself inside out and becomes limitation and then leaves limitation behind and becomes fullness again. That absolute boundless fullness is sustained forever now. So it should be apprehensible. Well, it's certainly beable, and the beability of it is what we're in right now. We're in the beability of the absolute. We are the beability of the absolute. We are the be-ness of the absolute. So God is beable, if I may say. Oh, let me put that crazy idea down. Let's say the absolute deity is, and I'll just, well, beable. Beable. Because this word is not showing a misspelling, I must have used it in infinitization. It's beable. Always. Now. But is it knowable? Now, some will say, well, it doesn't make any difference. You can be a man, you can be a god, and you can know the supreme. But I have this notion that there are intensities of realization for those who dwell within the point as the point, the one universal point. And there are different degrees of knowability depending upon the extension of emanation, of emanated rays, emanated points. If we are at a relatively low, or if we are deeply immersed in nascence, in matter, if we're low down in the stream of self-objectification, the knowability of the absolute deity will be very limited compared to knowability of that absolute deity if we are highly retracted, abstracted along the emanative stream. Of course, our first task is to know, well, to know the universal logos, the one universal point. We are emanations of that logos, and we are the logos itself, and we are the absolute deity itself. But our first task before dealing with the knowability of absolute deity is to deal with the knowability of these higher sources along the emanative stream, leading ultimately to the one universal source, the universal logos. And we are that, but to know we are that and to be that knowingly is something that, you know, in a sense exists even now, paradoxically, but has to be achieved by the retractable monad, the retractable point. Points and monads are in a way identical. So points and monads, identical. And maybe I can elaborate on that at some point. Leibniz, I think, Leibniz was dealing with monads as points. At least I seem to think so. It's something, a conclusion to which you are led when you contemplate the monad. Well, this has been a little bit of an introduction. You know, little piece of autobiography here. You will see that I flashed on a, I flashed on some kind of, letter to my friend. See, look at all this stuff. This is all this, these mathematical, sources, and I'm communicating with a dear friend from ancient days, who is really imagine a third ray soul, or a fifth ray soul and a third ray monad. Anyway, very much along the line, and we were both born into the Jewish race, and in this incarnation at least. And I said, well, it can be a disadvantage, and you see. You will see that in because I kind of flashed on that letter inadvertently. I didn't mean to do that, but as long as I did it, I won't remove it. I'll just explain it. I said it can be a disadvantage to be born into the Jewish group that we were both born into it, because it can lead to forgetfulness. And I'm talking with him right now about the reality of the soul as a psyche in perpetuity, as it were. Well, almost perpetuity. Something that survives the death of the physical aggregation. And I said, but, you know, the Jewish group has so much of the third ray and so much of the mentality that it can forget its origin. As God, it will all, you know, it will create distinctions See, I know I've been doing that all my life. I have a very substantial third ray in my nature. Once in a ray group some 30 years ago, those number three is always occurring. I think I've told this before, but I was having a dream, and around me were all these people, and I realized they were the rays. I was trying to figure out my own ray formula. Maybe I recognized different rays around me. The people represented the rays, and all of a sudden I started more or less like looking at the knees of someone, and I just started following up until I realized it was a very, very tall person. And I said, "Well, who are you?" This person was 9 feet tall. All right, who are you? And he says, "I am the third ray." Okay, I guess that's an impressive moment in one's psyche. I knew the third ray was really important. And he was 9 feet tall. Later, I didn't know at the time, but later I realized that nine is the cycle for the third ray. Stephen Pugh has done a lot of good work on that and bringing that point forward. When the third ray occurs cyclically, it's in nines, 90s, 900s, 9,000s, 90,000, like that, 900,000, so forth. That's the cycle of the third ray. So obviously, this being is very important in my own nature. I consider it at the present moment of my ignorance, such as it is, to be the third ray monad. I consider it that way. Although someone might say it's the third ray soul, but I don't think so. But I stand to be corrected on this point. The monad influences the mind. The monadic ray influences the mind. The soul ray influences the astral nature. The personality ray influences particularly the physical nature. And I think in my mind, which is largely third ray, I tend to, as you can see here, I tend to approach the clarification of being via the third ray. That's what I'm trying to do here. Clarify the nature of being, and I'm using the third ray method to attempt that. So I was writing to my friend, and I don't think we'll ever see eye to eye on these matters because he is so powerfully third and fifth ray, far more fifth ray than I have, and in a way far more disciplined third ray than I have. And I'm saying, well, look, it can be a disadvantage to be born in the group which represents the previous solar system because the third ray is so very strong. And we forget the higher worlds. And yet, through the mind, perhaps, it is possible to reapproach those worlds by serious abstract thinking, which gives way to the intuition of the Buddhic plane, which gives way to that type of reflection of the universal mind we call Atma, which is the three again, isn't it? So maybe using the number three, it is possible no longer to insist on remaining in forgetfulness. And we all know, with respect to the reappearance of the Christ, that the Jewish group must come to recognize the nature of the second ray, the nature of the Christ, and many, of course, already do, of course. But it's necessary for the third ray monads to transfer on to the second ray, from the third subplane of the monadic plane to the second subplane. And so, as I'm working with my friend, and maybe I have no business doing so, I'm sharing my point of view, and he's sharing his own very scientific, materialistic, I would call it, point of view. There's nothing real in our identity. When the body goes apart, the identity goes apart, and all that, So, I had written this funny thing, and I said, I substituted the word both for born, and I realized I had to make a correction. If one is both in the Jewish group, well, we are both, so I see why I did it, but I meant to say born in the Jewish group, then one may forget one's origin, is what I'm basically saying. And so much of my life has been an attempt to overcome death and to retrace my understanding, or to retrace the path that will lead my understanding to knowing my origin. And it will, of course, be the origin of everybody else as well, because all beings are one. This is my particular antikarana. This is my particular way of doing it. I've often said that, you know, you can approach the antikarana maybe in seven different ways, but I can think of three, you know, and you can simply assert beingness on the first ray. Well, you can use DK's method with his wonderful antikarana meditations, you know, using words of power and so forth, using the word, which is the second ray method, or you can maybe think your way into it. The philosophical approach, which I think was what people had to do before they were given the second ray method of doing, of reaching beingness, the beingness of the monad at least, which is ultimately the absolute beingness, but doesn't seem to be so at first. And then that first ray method, maybe first ray monads that just absolutely force the point. They insist on being. And they take the kingdom of heaven by storm, by violence. Like St. Paul, perhaps. The kingdom of heaven suffereth violence, and the violent take it by force. So, okay, that's all by way of a wordy explanation of why that funny little paragraph, which didn't belong, appeared. But it has a relation to what's going on here. So that we don't forget where we came from and what we are, but can, in our own way, retrace our steps back to the origin, the one and only origin, really. Even, you know, if you looked at, well, let's see. This is always the problem. When we speak of the origin, we can retrace our steps in various ways, but what I'm going to do here is show you what I mean with this particular diagram. And you say, well, what's the origin? Well, let's suppose one of us is this little ball. Well, our origin is this. But what's the origin of that? Well, it's this, and it's this, and it's this, and on and on and on and on. We have these temporary origins. But they are not the final origin. And the final origin of the point will end in pointlessness. And that's what I want to say that. The final origin of the point will end in pointlessness. Or I might have said the origin of pointness is pointlessness. So, yes, we will attempt to retrace, and according to your monadic ray or rays, as I think there are two monadic rays, I've explained that elsewhere in some of my commentaries. We will retrace ourselves, our steps, from pointness to pointlessness. Now, we can't do that in cosmos, in universe, because the universe itself is a point, the one universal point. But we may retrace from the one universal point when the time comes to pointlessness. And that is the true re-entry, at least the experiential re-entry into pointlessness. Now, of course, we're already there. That's the paradox. Don't have to re-enter anything. We're already pointless. And yet the point exists. Or seems to. Does the point exist? That is a question. Let's just say we are already forever pointless. So does the point exist? And we have to say, well, in the Mahamaya, it seems to forever. So what I'm going to do after this maybe a little odd introduction is to begin working with the secret doctrine. At least begin with the secret doctrine and proceed logically, hopefully logically, and certainly speculatively, and again, hopefully intuitively. I'll do that. And we will try to enter this domain. The man who, a very brilliant man, he wrote the introduction to my Infinitization of Selfhood, Tim Rudberg. Well, I can't quite pronounce this. Danish. Rudberg. R-U-D-B-O-G. He did a great job, I thought, and he called it Entering the Domain, and that stuck with me. He's a brilliant scholar in comparative religion and philosophy, and we will expect to hear great things from him in the now, I suppose, and in the future. So I will just say that if what is here said seems to leave far behind the practical life we all must live, I must state that it is ever my intention to return to such practicalities with a more illumined understanding and with greater capacity to serve all sentient beings. This is no escape or flight away from reality, because reality is in a way everything, even though illusion exists. So I certainly want to always return to the practicalities, and whether I succeed in doing that, we shall see. At least it is my good intention. And then I will also say that I think the thing to do, well, let's just call this is the end of, we'll call this the end of SNS, sequence and simultaneity and sequence number one. Well, maybe I'll spell it out. And today is the 13th of February, 2014. And I'm on page 2 of this little listing. So in order to really remain practical in closing this off, what I will do is offer us the great invocation, and we can pronounce that together, because after all, we are here improving the illusion, perfecting the illusion, archetypalizing the illusion, and the next big thing on our planet is the externalization of the hierarchy and the reappearance of the Christ. This is our duty, and so we must never lose sight of that, as far out there or in there as our thoughts may go. So, from the point of light within the mind of God, let light stream forth into the minds of men. Let light descend on earth. From the point of love within the heart of God, let love stream forth into the hearts of men. May Christ return to earth. From the center where the will of God is known, let purpose guide the little wills of men, the purpose which the masters know and serve. From the center which we call the race of men, let the plan of love and light work out, and may it seal the door where evil dwells. Let light and love and power restore the plan on earth. Okay, friends, onward, and I hope this is the day of, actually, full moon is coming here. We're just 2 days from the full moon of Aquarius, and even a bit less than 2 days, and I find this to be a good time to present these thoughts, so I hope I'm able to continue during this period. We'll see you then for program number 2, this one, about an hour and a half. See you soon. Bye-bye.